order for Tuesday, January 29th. We are going to continue with DHS reviews of the governor's budget proposals today. We're going to try to cover chemical and mental health, the Office of the Commissioner's transition to the community, and the Office of the Commissioner's Office of Inspector General overviews with time for questions of members. Just as a reminder, then tomorrow we may have a little bit, we may not be able to get through all of this today. If not, we will have the first part of tomorrow to finish whatever's not done today, and then we will begin public testimony. 1 or 2 days. We're already probably into 2 days worth of public testimony, so that would be Wednesday and Thursday of this week, just to give members a heads up what to expect. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yes, Senator, Mr. Chairman. Bills, do we have any idea? I would suppose the governor would have some bills to follow up with his proposals. Do you know where that's at or when we might see them?
Senator Kiffmeyer, we asked Assistant Commissioner Leitz over the health care division last week, and he wasn't able to offer a date certain. You know, typically we're still pretty early in the process. We're not used to seeing the bills that follow up on governor's proposals for some time, but I am requesting on behalf of the committee that we really try to speed that up and get those bills in front of us as soon as possible, just so that we can really get behind what these proposals are and give them their due hearing and make sure that we really understand and can use that as the starting place to begin our conversation. So, I mean, I don't have a date certain as of today, but we're all working as hard as we can to make sure that we get the information we need. And I tend to agree, Senator Kiffmeyer, that it is kind of what we're going to need next to flesh out what the details of these proposals are. So I'll call Dave Hartford, the Assistant Commissioner over Chemical and Mental Health Services, up to the table, and maybe you can help us, Dave, quickly get oriented in terms of the materials and how you're going to approach them. Members will remember we have the budget books, and I think you're going to be working primarily through the MMB documents that are the brief ones, and then cross-referencing the DHS fast facts. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's
great.
Correct.
Okay.
Morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. As you're just stating, I'll primarily be using
and
the
state
governor's
your name for the record, just for.
Excuse me, Dave Hartford, Acting Assistant Commissioner for Chemical and Mental Health Services.
Thank you.
And I will be primarily using the governor's the governor's change pages, and I'll just kind of walk through the items there. We do have fast facts available, but I'll be presenting so you can reference those. There are fast facts for the first 7 proposals. The last 2 do not have a fast facts page. So with that, I just wanted to, in opening, just address a little bit about the efforts of past administrations.
Can you pull that microphone a little closer?
Sure.
I'm having a little trouble.
Yes, I do.
As I was saying, there's been numerous past administrations' efforts at really transitioning the mental health delivery system in Minnesota. We've invested over time, made many changes in transitioning our system from an institutional-based system of care, public mental health care, to a community-based system. This transition has made it possible for thousands of Minnesotans to lead productive lives in their communities. And while Minnesotans are unquestionably better off.
I didn't catch what page we're on in the MMB.
Excuse me. I'll be covering 9 items starting on page 18.
Okay. Thank you.
While Minnesotans are unquestionably better off in the new system, challenges remain in maximizing its effectiveness. In this context, the Affordable Care Act introduces new opportunities. More people will have health insurance and access to behavioral health services. We have new opportunities to maximize our investments and create new models that deliver our triple aim of health care reform. The 9 bills I'll be presenting, as I said, start on page 18, and taken together, through redirecting of funds, savings, and new investments, the package has a net savings of $3.4 million after we redirect $9.2 million. This excludes the last item of the nine, which is returning $18 million from the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Fund to the general fund. So with that, I'll start with the first item on page 18 there, the mental health school link grants. The governor recommends doubling the capacity of our school link grants. This is going from currently we have 17% of our school districts have this service, and this will be doubling it, so we'll have 35% of our school districts covered. In fiscal year 10 and 11, these services provided care to 13,900 children, and of them, 7,200 of those children were served for the first time in the mental health system. 3,000 of them were from cultural minorities, and that was 840 different school sites where those services were administered. This service allows our mental health professionals to work within the schools and to do services that are billable through insurance. But in addition to that, this grant provides so they can identify and intervene conditions that could have been missed at a clinic or home setting. This allows other services that may not be covered by insurance, either through underinsured or uninsured, and reduces that issue of access for children where they may have difficulty getting to an appointment. These providers may provide consultation, care coordination, and promotion in the schools. This requires a new appropriation of $4.9 million for the biennium. The outcomes we're looking for out of this project are an increase in first-time users, increase in the number of schools providing mental health services, and lastly, an increase in the number of cultural minority students receiving health services. I guess Mr. Chair, if I should just keep going through the other items.
Yep. Press okay. On. If members have questions, they'll make them known.
Thank you. Next on the item on page 19 is provider reimbursement for clinical consultation. The governor recommends expanding provider reimbursement for time spent in clinical consultation to coordinate children's care in an MA benefit. Failure to coordinate care has been identified as one of the major reasons for increase in health care costs, and by developing this MA benefit, we will not only benefit from a federal match, we'll also create a financial incentive so providers will coordinate the care across primary care, social service agencies, corrections to improve the care. The benefit would be funded by reallocating $2.1 million currently used to fund a local share grant for children's targeted case management, for which we have no outcome data. This creates a savings to the budget of $494,000 in the biennium. The outcome measure that we're looking for in this is a reduction in the number of children with high-cost health conditions, which we define as healthcare costs in excess of $50,000 annually.
Mr. Hartford, could you tell us a little bit more about the local share grant program? You said there's no outcome measures for it, but how is it managed? And
these were dollars set aside that provide a share for children's targeted case management in the counties. So this is a grant that goes to counties, and then they use it in towards whatever services that they choose to direct that to.
And why are there no outcomes?
There has not. Measured. We don't receive data back around outcomes on how this is utilized.
So it doesn't mean that it isn't ineffective. Right. It just means that it hasn't really been measured
right.
at this point.
And it's anticipated that this new coordination would return more effectiveness to the system than these other dollars.
And the savings
are currently used.
Are the savings here generated from better utilization of the resources then, or are they?
The savings, Mr. Chair, are the difference between the $2.1 million currently allocated for the share and the cost of the of the new service.
Okay.
And that results in a net savings of $494,000.
Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, I've set aside my agenda. I apologize. Could you remind me of your name, please?
Mr. Hartford.
Mr. Hartford. Thank you. Mr. Hartford, you said this is coming from a county grant, but we're not sure what they do with it. Is there a backfill somewhere for what the counties do? I presume they're doing work with it. Or does the coordination of care benefit provide the backfill to the counties?
Senator Benson, Mr. Chair, I believe this function is a crossover, that there will be, this will backfill some of those services in terms of coordination.
Okay.
Okay. The next item is around establishing a psychoeducational benefit in medical assistance. This, again, is on page 19. That the governor recommends repurposing existing funding for the psychotherapy benefit to instead be used for psychoeducation benefit. What this means is it will allow providers to work with family members to educate them on really extending the treatment plan into the child's home and have family members as really part of that treatment team. This is a cost-effective and beneficial extension of care. There is no net budget change because the funding is anticipated to be a reduction in the use of psychotherapy. Psychotherapy requires the child to be present. Psychoeducation is just, we would utilize some of those dollars currently being used for psychotherapy to educate family members to extend that treatment plan. The performance measures for this, we need to complete a rollout with the providers, which means we would need to establish a baseline to increase the number of mental health professionals successfully completing training on delivery, documentation, and billing, and also to measure improvement in clinical outcomes. Next item is to expand the mental health crisis services. The governor recommends expanding mental health crisis response services to an additional 16 counties and two tribes. Currently, this service of mobile crisis is available in 59 counties for adults, 49 counties for children, and one tribe. The service helps people who are experiencing a mental health crisis either in their home or in the community, rather than in more restrictive environments like an emergency room or with potentially inappropriate use of law enforcement around the crisis. They respond whenever and wherever a person is in need of help. Crisis services are a covered MA benefit, and so what this proposal is looking for is an investment of $2 million for the biennium to start up costs for four teams for adults and children across 16 counties and two additional tribes. The performance measures for this proposal are to reduce the rates of suicide, hospitalization, and law enforcement involvement.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we know what two tribes would be receiving this, and is this something they have requested?
Mr. Hartford.
Senator Brown, Mr. Chair, I believe we do know it is available through an RFP process.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps you covered this already, but are the FTEs, where are they listed besides the big breakout spreadsheet, which I failed to bring? I would assume these have FTEs and they're not listed on either the yellow sheet or the fast facts or the.
Right. It's they're only on the budget proposal tracking document, which is the first tab in
okay.
your.
That's
it? Yeah, it's the first tab in your book. The
okay.
first pages have the FTEs. It's, I know it's a little bit of work to get through and find all these. Maybe, Mr. Hartford, do you know the FTEs in relation to this particular
Mr. Chair, no, I don't.
Okay. Senator Benson?
And Mr. Chair, and while I don't want to get on Mr. Albrecht's bad side, maybe from the information that's on the spreadsheet, we could get a total for the FTEs because I cannot find a total. They're in parentheses, and then when you get to the end, I can't find any total.
I don't think you'll get on Mr. Albrecht's bad side asking for where the FTEs are. It's something we all have an interest in. Do you have a total on that from this? If not, we should ask. I haven't seen a rolling total of all the FTEs in all these packages.
Mr. Chair, we can certainly get that information.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, thank you so much. And back to the mental health crisis response services, I would assume this is something that the state is paying for already in the other 59 counties. And perhaps either in your committee or Senator Sharon's committee, we can take a we'll be taking a look at mental health on a more holistic approach to see the funding, where it's been, where it's going, why it's
Okay, all right, good. Continue. Now, moving to page 20, looking at adjusting the adult rehabilitative mental health services, the governor recommends adjusting adult rehabilitative mental health services payment rate and provisions of services. Referred to as ARMS, these services are a foundational set of services that support people to manage their illness in the community. They are demonstrated to reduce inpatient hospitalization. In 2011, approximately 14,000 people were received ARMS services, helping them to successfully live at home. There's been no change in reimbursement since 2006 for these services, and the current rates are reported to not cover the service costs. We have lost more than 10% of our ARMS providers, and many other providers have reduced the availability of this service because they can't meet their costs, so they're supplying only what's necessary. This bill also seeks to add new service provisions that weren't in the original service package, such as functional assessments, clinical supervision, and transportation costs. There's no net change in budget from this proposal. It will be funded by repurposing funds from either the Adult Integrated Fund or the Community Support Program.
Mr. Hartford, out in the tails in 17, there's a cost. I don't know where that creeps in eventually. How does that mechanism work?
And as these grow over time, we anticipate this service would grow over time. This guarantees for that zeroing out for the first number of years, Mr. Chair, that would be funded by one of these two other funds, but then those tails would grow in those outer years. So it's not a long, a complete package for the long haul.
Would that continue to grow in 18 and 19, or would that million in 17 be kind of stable, just for thinking?
I believe it, Mr. Chair, that it would stabilize over time. And again, this is a service that reduces inpatient hospitalization. It would stabilize out over time. Yes.
Okay. Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Hartford. It says in the performance measures that you expect a 25% reduction in mental health hospital inpatient days. So do we see a corresponding reduction in the growth of MA hospital for these patients?
Mr. Hartford.
Senator Benson, Mr. Chair, we would anticipate to see those reductions in hospitalization that would reflect from the other MA. The challenge is trying to capture the specifics of that as some services are done. We have a challenge, I think, in capturing that data.
And so it would be my understanding that you haven't captured that data. It's not part of the zero budget. If we do receive that savings, as we work on a fiscal note and further refine it, we might actually see some of those savings show up.
That's right, Mr. Chair.
Good. We'll look forward to that.
Next, mental health specialty treatment service. The governor recommends establishing a pilot program for a 24/7 medically monitored mental health specialty treatment service. We've known for a number of years now that we have a gap in our service delivery system between inpatient hospitalization and community-based residential care for persons with complex either medical or behavioral health issues. And this pilot starts to address that problem. Individuals who need continued medical monitoring because of the complexity of their condition or require a longer length of stay than is currently available through medical assistance, this would help fill that gap. This represents a small number of people who tend to accumulate non-hospital days that are not required and tend to clog our mental health inpatient system. This is a recognized gap, and it has significant impact on psychiatric bed availability. This pilot would be licensed and funded as an IRTS, Intensive Residential Treatment Service, with $2 million for the biennium funded by the SOS Special Revenue Account. This account is from collections from SOS residential programs. The performance measure for this pilot is to reduce the number of non-acute bed days at Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center.
Okay. Mr. Hartford, in what sense is this a pilot program is one thing? I mean, I see it for the full 4 years that we look at in our budget.
In that this is another level of service that's not really part of our array of services today in the state. It's a pilot in that sense that is developing a level of care that doesn't exist today.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Hartford. This affects a relatively small number of individuals per year. Can you help us quantify? Are we talking tens, hundreds?
It's anticipated this particular target population, 50 to 60 individuals.
Yeah. Okay. And just, I mean, I guess when I think of a pilot, I think of a limited duration thing, too. I mean, that's where my disconnect was. So, I mean, you're just talking about building a new service, and your expectation is that it'll work and it'll continue.
Mr. Chair, pilot in the sense that there may be other patient populations who also require a specialty service. So this is targeting a particular problem that we know we have today to develop and evolve a service and looking at potentially other patient populations in the future.
Okay. Senator Rosen?
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a tremendous amount of money for 50 to 60 people, $1 million per year. I'm just wondering if there's some other, I understand it's a pilot program, that's a pretty expensive pilot program. I'm not sure if there's another avenue we can take them, keep them there where they're at. I mean, I understand the need to do something different with this population, but that's pretty rich.
It's a big number.
That's a very big number that we're concentrating on.
We'll look forward to getting more details on exactly how this works and you know, how it'll, you know, it's budget neutral and that these are monies that are spent on this population today. Is that my understanding as well? I mean,
they're monies that are collected through from the SOS collections from the existing in residential programs.
Okay. Senator Sharon?
Thank you, Senator. Are you able on this, because of the number, are you, and I understand the backlog in the hospitals, you can't get them out of the hospital into a community because it's the right level of service isn't there for the level of difficulty, but they're well enough to get out of the highly intensive. So there's motivation to loosen that system up and make those beds available. So is there, and have you measured what the cost is of not making this change so that we can look at this number in relationship to the existing systems cost? Otherwise, it's difficult to understand that we might be paying this much per. You know, we have people that have been stuck in highly intensive treatment programs in our region and that have been costing this much,
yep.
Just one or two individuals. So I think it might be helpful to us to see this in relationship to what it is that we're trying to fix.
Yes.
Senator
Mr.
Chair.
Mr. Hartford, any
Senator
response?
Sharon, Mr. Chair, we will endeavor to get that in that format so you can understand it better.
Thank you.
Okay, the next item is on also on page 20. It's referred to as health workforce, substance abuse screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment. This is often referred to as SBIRT. The governor recommends funding training for primary care physicians to use SBIRT process to identify people at risk and to intervene and refer to treatment. This SBIRT is an evidence-based practice to create earlier interventions to take place in primary care clinics, emergency rooms, trauma centers, and other community settings. This is asking for a new appropriation for $600,000 for the biennium to train physicians in this evidence-based practice. The performance measure is to measure the number of primary care physicians trained in utilizing this evidence-based practice.
Mr. Hartford, do you have a performance measure that says how much you'll expand it? I mean, is it just says to expand it? You know, how many more sites? I mean, I've heard a lot about this and a lot of really good things about this as an evidence-based approach to really catching a lot of these issues early on when you can really address them in a better manner than if they're allowed to go on. So, I mean, how much expansion do you anticipate with this investment?
Mr. Chair, we're currently evolving the strategies, if you will, to roll this out and create the venues to get to the primary care physicians to get them trained. So we have not been able to calculate our goal here yet.
Okay. Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hartford, is this part of the statewide substance abuse strategy? I would assume it have to be. And the second question is the training materials that are to be provided, is that extended education? Is that just somebody comes in and goes to this primary care facility and says, this is what you need to ask? I don't understand what the training materials would be at a primary care facility.
Senator Rosen, Mr. Chair,
Hartford.
The curriculums have been developed. The venues have not been developed for this, for getting this rolled out. I think that's where the challenge that we have today is what are the appropriate, and we're pursuing contracting with a number of other agencies currently to help us in the rollout, or also with the University of Minnesota, and we're trying to develop strategies because the curriculum is finished. We have done some training, have a small number of physicians trained already, so really looking at that. And, yes, it is part of the substance abuse strategy as an important element of moving to earlier intervention around substance abuse and really getting the entire healthcare delivery system engaged in addressing issues of substance abuse.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hartford. I was going to ask you about the no current baseline, but you referred to a small number of physicians being involved, and so I'm going to just presume that's why there's no current baseline. How small is the number of physicians currently involved, and what will this grow to? And third, are we focusing on highest impact in the most affected communities to help us with some of our disparities issues?
Mr. Hartford.
Senator Benson, Mr. Chair, the baseline that we have today, I would suspect, is under 100 physicians that I'm aware that have been formally trained. There are a number of health plans and other partners in this that are currently also looking to roll out SBIRT within their systems. So, again, outcome measures, we're still in an evolutionary phase in this, and I would hope to get better numbers moving forward.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Benson. Hartford, I did ask about disparities. It's something that keeps coming up, if you could address that.
Senator Benson, Mr. Chair, there is not a component today in the rollout, in the strategies today, but I certainly acknowledge that that's an important element that needs to be part of our rollout strategy.
Thank you.
Okay, the next item somewhat confusing in the name. It's labeled as Eliminate Alternative to Moose Lake Grant. The governor
I've been waiting for this. Moose Lake is 11 miles east of me. I'm like, what is the governor doing to me?
Well, Mr. Chair, sometimes labels last a long time.
Yes, okay.
The governor recommends eliminating grants used to subsidize programs in non-metro hospitals. This operating subsidy was created in 1995 with the closure of Moose Lake State Hospital to support hospitals in caring for people who would be committed to the regional treatment centers. This operating subsidy was expanded to hospitals across the state. There are currently 9 hospitals receiving this operating subsidy. Our system has changed dramatically since 1995. All kinds of community-based services have been put in place. The regional treatment centers have closed. Lengths of stay have changed dramatically. In 1995, we anticipated a typical average length of stay for a civilly committed person of 45 days. In the community hospitals, persons that are civilly committed have a typical length of stay of approximately 16 days. These grants do not fund individual patients, but are just operating subsidies. And again, there aren't outcome data, if you will, attached to individual patients around. These are operating subsidies that were to support the psychiatric programs as we transitioned our system of care. These hospitals also have what's referred to as an MA, medical assistance fee-for-service contract, and that provides extended psychiatric inpatient care to individuals. This base contract, we have currently 18 community hospitals that have the MA fee-for-service contract. This will continue and is an important part of our mental health delivery system. Eliminating this subsidy grant will provide $4.3 million in savings in the biennium.
$5.3 million
in the biennium.
And there's it's the same 18 hospitals that get the grant and the support, or?
Mr. Chair, this is a general. The metro hospitals never received a subsidy grant. So they're Greater Minnesota hospitals, or not? I believe it's 9 hospitals in Greater Minnesota that receive the operating subsidy. So that's just an additional payment that those hospitals receive.
And they're all located throughout Greater Minnesota?
Throughout Greater Minnesota. It's not a it started the first one, the first concept of this was around the Moose Lake closure, but it really went to hospitals across the state.
Geographically diverse at this point. Okay, well, we'll be looking forward to see more of the details. And then
lastly, what's referred to as one-time reduction in the Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. The governor recommends a one-time transfer of unspent funds in the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund to the general fund. This was due to lower than forecasted spending over the last few years. In fiscal year 11, our actual balance forward was $13 million. Now in fiscal year 12, our actual balance forward is $18 million. So again, looking to transfer this and sweep the fund of this unspent dollars to the general fund.
And that's the last of your
And that's the last of my
your
items,
Mr. Chair. Questions of members. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Harford, have we ever had a balance of this magnitude in the consolidated fund?
Senator Rosen, Mr. Chair, I believe that's a fairly routine number that has rolled forward over time, and the unspent dollars are then typically rolled forward into the general fund.
Okay.
Other questions of members?
I don't know.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Hartford, where does the money come from for the Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund?
Mr. Hartford.
That, Senator Benson, Mr. Chair, that's a combination of funding that comes from county, approximately 22% share from the counties, federal government is in that proximity from our block grant, and the remainder is appropriation from the state.
There was a breakdown of that in some of the early overviews that we saw. I don't know if you kept those, but in one of the slides, it went over the CCD, the consolidated fund, and its allocation, and it's a big pot of money with many sources coming in, and it's the consolidated fund. So I don't know if we can probably.
I saved it all. I'll go do my homework.
There is a slide on that. Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To our testifier, when you said that it was lower than predicted use of the consolidated treatment fund, can you say more about that? Is that because less people needed chemical dependency treatment or because of restraints that we put on who can use the fund? Or it seems to me, Mr. Chair, that we did some work on this, I think, last year where we started to cap how many times people could have treatment and what frequency. Do we think that that is the driver of this or just that the need wasn't there?
Mr. Hartford.
Senator Hayden, again, this is a very complicated, and Mr. Chair, this is a very complicated fund, lots of moving parts around how it gets used and not used. I suspect that one of the other drivers is more individuals being covered by private insurance also impacts utilization of the fund. So as we move forward over time, more people having insurance, that impacts it also.
Senator Lurie.
Senator Sharon.
Have we made changes in this, the contributions to this fund to the counties and increase their obligations in the recent past?
Mr. Hartford.
Senator Sharon, Mr. Chair, I do not believe there's been adjustments to county share. Excuse me, I'm mistaken. I'm going to ask.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
I'm Shirley Jacobson. I am the financial officer for Chemical and Mental Health Services, and I believe it was last year that we increased the county's share from 16% to 22%.
And may I follow
Senator
up?
Senator
Sharon. And so then, in order to have the access to these funds, is the decision to utilize these resources, is that a local decision or is that made at the state level?
Senator Sharon, Mr. Chair, that is in the state of Minnesota, the counties are the placing authority for people accessing the chemical dependency treatment fund.
And so it is possible in the analysis that if you increase the county's responsibility when they don't have the resources to pay for it, and they're the ones making the decisions on utilization, that it isn't need, the reduction in need that is creating this, but it is the difficulty of counties to bear more and more of the state's responsibilities on property taxes.
Yes, and that gets to Senator Hayden's point. And I think there's a broad recognition that there is a real need for more and good evidence-based chemical dependency issues. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. If we continually or over the course of time run excess to where it goes back to the general fund, why did we increase the county's obligation to this fund? And the second question would be, wouldn't it make sense instead of returning all of this to the general fund to, if the counties are paying in whatever portion they're paying in, that we give part of this back to the counties instead of rolling it into the general fund?
Mr. Hartford.
Senator Brown, Mr. Chair, this is a forecasted fund, so the dollars, this was a forecasted amount of an appropriation. The county share is not accumulated in that fund until it's spent, until the counties actually spend the money. So these dollars are not containing county dollars because this is a state appropriation into the fund, if I'm not mistaken.
Ms. Jacobson,
knows it much better than I do.
Senator, the counties pay in a portion of the fund dollars that have been paid out. So when this accumulation, it's just the combination of county funds, it's state funds, it's all funds that were left over in the fund at the end of the year. Our choice to put this to the general fund was a one-time sweep for the purposes of removing that excess from the fund. There was no intent that this was anything that we wanted to see continue to accumulate.
Senator Brown?
Mr. Chair, I'm still not understanding why did we raise the county's percentage of obligation to this if we're running excess? Maybe I'm missing your point.
I'll have to get you the information related to that fiscal note.
Thank you. I'll look forward to that.
Any other questions? Seeing none. Thank you, Ms. Jacobson, Mr. Hartford. We will call up Deputy Commissioner Ann Berry to cover the transition to the community portion from the Office of the Commissioner. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ann Berry, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. And I'm here to talk about those budget pages that relate to transition to the community. Let me just start very quickly with a broad brush. It is certainly a belief of the department and embedded in the governor's budget, a strong belief that people, all people, including people with disabilities, should live in the most integrated environments, and that those are based upon a set of choices that people can make about where they live. So these budget proposals all really are combined together. We think of them as one proposal with slightly different emphasis in each case, so that we can begin to do a better job of transitioning people from our institutional facilities and into the community. We don't do that alone. We do that in partnership with the counties, and we have to work closely with the courts to, in fact, ensure that people are ready to move into the community. But funding for those alternatives shouldn't be the barrier. So that's why included in the governor's budget are these three proposals that specifically relate to moving people more aggressively or more quickly to the community. The budget pages that relate to these specific proposals start on page 12. That's going to take you back in your budget. I apologize for that. When Lauren Coleman was doing his presentation for the continuing care area of our department, he mixed into his proposals was also a proposal around transition to the community. It's a rather substantial amount of resources. $3.3 million in 14 and another $4.8 million, or roughly thereabout, in fiscal year 2015. This proposal is specifically targeted at clients who are currently at Anoka Regional Treatment Center and at the Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter. We will, as I said earlier, much more aggressively work to provide resources so that we can build and develop alternatives in the communities so that people with mental health issues with the appropriate wraparound services can live in their communities. Included here are a number of performance measures that we would actually increase the number of people living in the community from Anoka. We would discharge or provisionally discharge an additional 50 people a year, and at St. Peter, that number would be an additional 25 people a year. We currently do provisionally discharge people into the community, but this would at least double that rate in the next biennium.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Berry, is this putting pressure on the healthcare professionals who are caring for these individuals to possibly release them before they think it might be appropriate?
Mr. Chair and Senator, in all cases, at least at the security hospital, that decision rests with the court and is based upon a recommendation of the treatment team that, in fact, these clients are ready to move into the community. So we rely upon the work of the treatment team. The county also makes a recommendation about whether they feel a client is ready to move back into the community. It all works nicely if we agree on somebody's ability and readiness to move to the community. But it always starts with the recommendation of the treatment team in our facilities.
Senator Laurie.
And Mr. Chair, I thought I understood
Senator
you
Brown.
To say we're asking them to release an additional 50 per year. Isn't that sort of putting some pressure upon them to do that? Can't they use their own judgment for that?
Ms. Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, we have taken a look, very carefully reviewed the clients that are currently in our facilities, and it is the belief of our treatment teams that these people are ready to move into the community. The barrier has been alternative community resources to fund their needs in the community.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, and I appreciate your questions. We have a lot of history moving people out of intensive care because it's expensive into the community at a lower cost, but is it what are we doing to make certain that it's not premature and creating community crises that we don't like? But my question goes back to does this change in how we move people into the community change this county's obligations, increase their obligations again? Do they pay a higher percentage of the community-based services and as opposed to what they would be paying if they stay in these treatment facilities? And if so, are there other adjustments elsewhere to not just shift the obligations again onto our counties?
Ms. Berry?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, later on in the budget pages, there is a cost of care change for the counties, specifically for clients at Anoka and Minnesota Security Hospital who have been deemed appropriate and ready to move into the community. These proposals are wrapped together in many ways because we want to align the incentives appropriately, and we know and have heard that the counties are not in favor of this change. But the decision, the committing court comes out of the county. People, particularly at Security Hospital, clients come to us, and there's real differences about who is committed and the length of time they're committed to our programs. We feel it's appropriate to remove any disincentives to moving people into the community, and whatever those are, the resources should then be put back into the community to fund the alternatives. So, as a package, what these proposals together really do is create an environment where there aren't any incentives to leave somebody where they are past the time that they really need the level of care that's being provided, and then turn around and take all those resources and put them right back into the community to build the alternatives. The alternative to that would be to just put more resources into the alternative, but I'm not sure that will fix what is a problem today, which is very different patterns across the state of who gets committed to our programs. We saw the same issue in the sex offender treatment program, and the legislature changed the participation rate for the counties for that program as well. So, again, it's about aligning those incentives. We know that there'll be disagreements, and those who don't like the proposal to increase the county share, and there'll be lots of questions about it. But we also, as I said, want to take those resources and put them right back into the community so that there aren't any barriers to people moving into the community.
Ms. Berry, we have a couple other questions, but let me just ask you this. I see you've got some performance measures where you're hoping to reduce the utilization more intensive things and keep people in community-based settings. Are these numbers projecting savings for that, or is this just the costs similar to the chemical dependency issues we went through? Are you projecting savings from the lower level of care, the home and community-based level of care, rather than the institutional setting?
Mr. Chairman, what we know right now is we have a number of people who are trying to get into Anoka and some who are trying to get into the competency restoration program at St. Peter, and we're finding it difficult to move people as quickly into the system as we can. As you are aware, we have people who are waiting in jail to move into our competency restoration program. The county sheriff's offices across the state would like us to be able to move them within 24 hours. To be able to do that, we need more beds to be able to do that. The best way for us to free up beds in our system is to move people into the community who are ready to go there and don't need those institutional beds. So this system it operates best when we can move people to the level of care they need at the right time, and right now we're not able to do that. So we're not projecting any savings here, but I think it's reasonable to expect that over the long term, if people are served where they should be served, and in fact, if we were to move upstream and provide services to people so that they might not need an institutional level of care because alternatives exist in the community, then over time we should see cost savings.
We have several questions. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Commissioner Berry. There are a couple things here in the reading of this that I know it's a cost thing sometimes. You know, the focus of it is that institutions are not necessarily the best place, and that if they've graduated out, we should let them graduate, not permanently stay in high school or anything like that. So if they graduate out, we want to do that and have a good transition. But the cost thing, so does the state pay 100% if they're in this particular kind of institution? And who pays if they move into the home and community-based? Because I think that's kind of the crux of the issue that I'm hearing you talk about.
Ms. Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, it's really, there is a mix of funding. So counties currently have a cost of share for programs in Anoka and Security Hospital. This would, there's currently, and I'm looking for my notes. I want to say that at Security Hospital, it's a 10%. I'm sure there are people who can assist me. That there is a 10% cost of share at Security Hospital, and I want to say it is a 25% at Anoka. These proposals really focus in on the back end so that anyone who's been in, for example, in Anoka for more than 60 days at a level that of acute, no longer has acute care needs, that increases, that share increases. So that, to your basic question, there is currently a county share. This increases that county share. It accelerates that county share for people who are ready to move into the community. Tom Reuter is here. He can give us the exact shares as they exist today in those programs.
Welcome. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Thomas Reuter. I am the Director of Operations Support for State Operated Services. The current county share for individuals who are committed to the Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter is 10%. And then the county share for individuals who receive services at the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center is a scale based on where they're at in their length of stay and whether or not they meet the criteria for continued stay in the facility.
Go ahead.
And Mr. Chairman, I would also add that the other part of the senator's question was about who funds home and community-based services. Well, that's a mix of state and federal dollars. We will also, though, in those cases, have to add on some service dollars because the waivers, as they're currently constructed, really don't contemplate people that have as many needs as the clients we are talking about. So people who have severe mental health issues, we'll talk about one of the proposals that specifically focuses in on people who have a mental health issue and a chronic health condition, like maybe diabetes. They're very fragile because of diabetes, or they have some other chronic condition. That requires an even greater level of care in the community to be able to fund that in our waiver would be almost on our current waiver structure would be almost impossible. So we would use these dollars, if appropriated by the legislature, to add on to what is already state and federal dollars going to fund people in the community.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rosen is next, and then Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Deputy Commissioner Berry. Perhaps we can drill down in this area a little bit more. I think there's a lot of questions. There's a tremendous amount of money that's being spent on this population. I'd like to get a little more detail about how much is being spent on the 50 or 60 that are supposed to be serviced with the hopes of more being able to capture more dollars from others that are going to be released. But when you look at the county share that's going to be going out, this is a this needs a little more attention. I think we're throwing money at something, and we're not sure what the results are going to be, in hopes that there will be savings, but at a cost to the counties that have to participate in this. And I was just looking at the Fast Facts, too. It says creates grants to train mental health providers in treating people with complex. This is all very fuzzy and nebulous, and I'm just a little I would like to, I guess, have a breakdown on a sheet of how much is being spent in this particular budget for this mental health agenda.
Yes.
If we could get that, that would be great.
Yes. I think it would, and again, I think we can drill down a little bit here. I think the best way is going to be to, again, encourage the department to get the bills over here and get fiscal notes drafted, and we'll really be able to bring these things to life and have a much more in-depth conversation. Whatever light you can shed today would be helpful toward that end, but that's where we need to be going, I think, on a pretty fast track.
And
Commissioner Berry. Senator Sharon is next. Is it a...
If I could, to that point.
Yeah, to that point, Senator Benson.
It would be helpful, in addition to the bills and the fiscal notes, if we could have an overview of what currently exists in mental health services and what the new model looks like. If we tie dollars to it, then this committee would be appropriate. But for those of us who are also on policy, it would just be helpful to understand the changes in policy. And so, no questions. Thank you.
You know... Commissioner Berry, that is a good point. I mean, maybe we should get just a one-pager on the whole issue of your focus on transition into the community rather than each of the separate budget items. I think that would kind of give – and where we are today, what the problems are, and where globally we're moving with this set of packages. Is that would that be responsive and something that you might be able to help us with to just get behind this and drill down a little bit better?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. We can put together a one- or two-page document that lays out the system as it exists today. And we can also get at that issue of why it's so costly mm-hmm. to serve people in community on top of the current waiver costs. You know, those waiver costs are based on averages to demonstrate to you and provide a compelling argument for why these why it's more expensive to serve some people in the community. So we should be able to provide you with information about the kind of clients we're talking about as well. I think that might be very helpful, so you would get a picture of what it is we're trying to accomplish. But we can also at the same time look at what currently exists today and the system in its entirety.
Yeah, I think that would be very helpful. It's akin to what Senator Sharon was talking about in one of the last discussions in the chemical and mental health division. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. This, in addition to all of this, that I am very interested in taking a look at, even though it may, in some special populations, the community-based costs are higher than typically because of the unique nature, but they don't need to hike it. But we need to understand what we're asking our counties to do, because these things aren't just conceptual about it's better to serve in the community-based system than it is in intensive care, high cost. We also should be looking at how our formulas are laid out in terms of who's responsible for those costs once the transition is made, and then ask how are we as a state partnering with the counties to resolve these issues. But my question, it may be more policy. I hope you'll forgive me if I'm taking too much of your budget time for this, but you made reference, Commissioner, to another goal here, which is to create at least a similarity in commitment processes and decision-making across the state rather than an irregularity in the commitment process. Can you tell me what it is you're referring to and how you see this helping that? How does this attack that particular problem?
Commissioner Berry?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, I'm going to take a step back for a moment. 2 years ago when we got the report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor about the sex offender treatment program, what we saw was very different commitment patterns in 87 counties. If we take a look at what we know now about commitments to Security Hospital in Anoka, we can see that there are very different patterns across the state. And what we think it relates to is the kind of resources that are available in the community to serve people when they're ready to move into community. Now, you know, we agree completely that there's a burden being placed on communities who are going to build more alternatives. We all know how difficult it is to site and place programs in communities across the state. This will not be easy for anyone, for the state and particularly for the counties, because they will be the ones responsible for making sure we build these alternatives. But without those alternatives in place, there are plenty of times when there is no other choice than to commit someone to an institutional placement. I think we all want to remove that as the reason for placement in any of our institutions. And that could be stated very broadly, not just to Anoka or not just to the Security Hospital at St. Peter. That's true of any institutional placement. So we can get you more detail also on county committing patterns and where people are committed, mm-hmm. and we can also talk about community resources. But I do think there's a relationship. We've looked, and we think there is a strong relationship between the levels of commitment and the number of people who are placed in institutions.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for allowing us to drill down on this. And I would, this is when we need that whiteboard. Seriously. and my interest is to figure out on page 46 of your Fast Facts, increased county payment to Anoka is $1.89 million for 14-15, and for St. Peter is $6.29. I'd like to know even further where the counties get their, how they get funding for these hospitals and well, of course, we'll probably get their opinions, too, when we see the bills on these. But where they're going to, is this going to come out of transportation? Is there another fund that we haven't got to in the governor's proposal that's going to help them find, $6 million?
Right.
That's a tremendous amount of money.
I haven't looked at our testifiers, but I'm betting the counties are on the list for tomorrow.
<That's right.
laughs> Okay. Commissioner Berry, any response today?
I fully expect, Mr. Chairman, I fully expect that the counties will let you know, as they've let us know,
yes.
That they have many, many concerns about this proposal. They're clearly in favor, at least the responses that we have gotten, they're clearly in favor of the state putting more resources into alternatives in the community. I think we all understand sort of the budget constraints we're working on when the department put together its budget. We saw a number of ways that we could align incentives at the same time we could put resources in the community. So the money that's in this budget goes right back to communities. Almost all of it goes right back to communities to build those alternatives. Counties who do a really good job, I mean, if you think about this over the long term, counties who do a good job of placement in the community won't pay a county share. They won't have that county share to pay for. Now, we need to think about how that plays out over time. But, again, think ahead to realigning incentives, and if alternatives exist and courts don't commit people to institutional placements, they reduce their obligation for a county share. So, you know, that's why we hope to be able to have this conversation about what's the best way to move this system in a direction that we all play a part in so that people can live in communities of their choice.
Further questions? All right, then. Item number two.
Well, the first item was the big item. The first item was really the big item, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman, which was to put together this package around transitions. And we've heard loud and clear that what you'd like is for us to put it, really to put it together as a single proposal so that you can look at it in its entirety and look at how it changes the status quo, how it changes the system that exists
yes.
today. So then really the only
That's
other...
well stated, and that is what we're looking for and really look forward to seeing that.
So the next piece then I have to talk about, the next part of the budget that I have to talk about is Fast Facts, page 47. And in your numbers document. It's your budget document. It's on page 22. And this is the growth in the Minnesota Sex Offender Treatment Program. When I was before you maybe a week ago, a little over a week ago, I laid out for you the patterns of growth that we're seeing in the Sex Offender Treatment Program. We know that, I've said this already once, maybe twice today, that the courts commit people to us and the courts make the decision about placement, provisional discharge and placements into the community. We don't have a lot of control over the number of the number of people or clients who come to our programs. But so this is a representation. This is not a forecasted program. So this is a representation of the costs over the next biennium for the projected growth in these programs. We're on track for growth in these programs. There's nothing that would suggest to us that without changes in statute, this growth won't occur. However, it's not included in your budget document, but I'd like to state that there are alternatives. The task force that has been working on sex offender programs and sex offender treatment has made recommendations about alternatives to placement, really alternatives at the front end of commitment. We are very interested in working with you, not only with the task force, but certainly with the committee. These resources could be used to fund alternatives if appropriate. But we also feel an obligation and a responsibility to say, this is what growth costs. This is the cost to run these programs. We need this appropriation so we can serve who we're currently serving.
Yep. That makes sense to me. Is that your last item?
That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions from members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
On this particular, I know you have been working very diligently on this, and so I was just wondering if you could, if you have a game plan of how this is going to, the MSOP is going to be moving forward.
Yeah, well, we have recommendations from the task force regarding development of less restrictive alternatives. To put this in context, you know, the federal courts have allowed and certified a class for a class action suit against the state challenging the constitutionality of our current sex offender program and its structure. And the courts have indicated that they're taking this issue very, very seriously. And, I mean, really what's at stake is whether they come in and put us under a receivership and take control of our program, and then we have no say over how it plays out in our budget, and that makes me incredibly nervous. Or absolute worst case scenario is they could actually rule that the manner in which we approach the sex offender treatment program is unconstitutional and disband the program. That's an even worse scenario for the state of Minnesota. So they required the commissioner of the Department of Human Services to form this task force. We've worked very hard to make sure that it's approached on a bipartisan basis in the Senate. Senator Limmer and I have both been attending these task force meetings and working together. I think there's been a lot of good work done on it. Commissioner Berry made mention of the OLA report that we got in 2011. I know that then Senator Berglund and Senator Hahn and I worked on a bill that was responding to the OLA's concerns. I know that Senator Limmer and Representative Cornish worked on a menu of ideas, I think they called them. It was not really introduced as a bill, but there were some really good ideas in there, some that were better than others. But between those two packages of ideas, I think there's a lot to work on to really move this program forward, create those less restrictive alternatives, and really do a better job of putting the constitutional underpinnings behind this program so that we can continue to stay in control of it here in the state. It is, of course, a very difficult conversation to have. A couple of the things that came out of the task force that were important to me and that I don't believe are in that package of between the two bills that have been introduced yet that we will need to be working on is that when we create the less restrictive alternatives, we really need to address head-on, and this was a strong recommendation out of the task force, we need to look at siting and make sure that we don't just send all of our sex offenders to downtown Minneapolis.
That's right.
That's kind of been what's happened with this population. If we're going to build these, they're going to have to be regional in nature in some manner, and we're going to have to grapple with that. The other piece that I don't believe is in either of the two bills yet in a fully fleshed out form is a really good recommendation on some strong funding for community engagement and education activities. I mean, I think that the legislature, we all know, we run a real risk if we get ahead of the communities and their readiness to engage more fruitfully on these really difficult conversations. And so I was glad to see that as a recommendation coming out of the task force. We need to pay close attention to that and really engage the communities across Minnesota broadly in the discussion about why we're making some of these difficult changes. And truthfully, perspective-wise, we were all asked at a couple of task forces ago, what is your vision? What should we be doing as a general direction? And I have done a lot of thinking on this, and I try to frame it as, really what we're trying to accomplish is we have very limited resources as a state. Always there's budget pressures, and it's my hope that we can use those scarce public resources to the best use to reduce the occurrence of sexual violence in our communities. And MSOP program is one of the uses of those dollars, but in our current construct, it sucks up all of the resources that we have toward those broad goals, and it really doesn't meet that more global directive that we should all be trying to work toward. And so I think that there's a lot of work to be done. I'm going to be sitting down with Senator Limmer and the department and trying to put these pieces together into a comprehensive package that can hopefully be introduced, and hopefully we can have really good policy and evidence-based conversations around them on a really nonpartisan matter. That's my hope, and if we succeed, we should really be in a better place in terms of where we are as a state. So that's a brief summary of where we're at today. We don't have a bill today, but I think we have most of the components already laid out and a lot of good thinking behind them. And if members are interested in doing some research, I would go to those two resources and help me think about it. Always welcome more ideas. Senator Rosen?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your work on that in a very bipartisan way, and you have been very, very diligent about that, because this program is, I could be wrong, but it is probably one of the top 3 to 5 cost drivers in our state. I mean, the cost of this program is, it's not going to stop unless we get our hands around it. So it's going to drain this budget dry. So I was just wondering, for the new members, if we could get a breakdown on what we do spend on the program already, cost per offender in the program, how much it's costing them, and the various differences between some of the programs, too, just to kind of brief us for moving forward and doing some good work in this area.
Yeah. There's a wealth of material already available, PowerPoint presentations. If there's the community interest, the interest around the committee, maybe we could have a hearing on just where we're at today. I mean, I think it might be fruitful. I mean, and also that could go a long way in the bringing the communities along to help understand some of this. So maybe we will try to add a hearing on that in the very near future. Senator Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, this is a growing problem. Are we looking at funding that addresses the root core issues as to why this is a growing problem, why we are seeing such an increase in sex offenders? Are we looking at any funding that would address the problem, the root of the problem, and try to deal with it from that point instead of having this culture of ever-increasing problem with sex offenders?
Senator Brown, I really welcome your pushing on that. It is one of my – it's, again, you know, when we – when all of our resources – again, thinking broadly, we're trying to use our scarce public resources to reduce the occurrence of sexual violence in our communities. When we use all of our resources on the 600 worst of the worst, you know, that are – you know, those in our MSOP program right now, it really changes our societal view of what this problem is in a way that isn't helpful to us in addressing it. And I think that moving some of our investments upstream towards prevention and getting at some of the root cause of what we see in our community and better understanding what sexual violence is and having more evidence-based, appropriate and effective interventions, we could do so much better with the spending than is what we see today. So, I mean, I welcome your push on that, and it is well within my vision to move some of the funding upstream towards prevention, a public health approach, take a good look at what the problem we're trying to address is and what the right policy levers we have at our disposal and funding mechanisms to, you know, appropriately intervene and really do right by our communities. Senator Sharon.
This is I'm changing the subject, if that's okay with you. But this is another example of the focusing on the caboose mm-hmm. rather than on the engine. So, and we do this way too much. So I'm glad people are interested in getting our vision upstream a yeah. long way. But this is not related to anything in the budget, and you can cut me off if you don't want me to do this now, but since the Assistant Commissioner Berry's here, I want to mention to you something that we discussed yesterday in health policy, and that is, and I don't see anything here in the budget, I'm curious to know what it is in terms of resources are going to be utilized to address the issue at the Security Hospital that has been ongoing for a substantial period of time that I constantly get questions as to why we don't see a change in the benchmarks on injuries to employees because of their work with, seriously persistently ill persons whose impulse control is poor and they are aggressive and they are violent. And we know that the hospital has a temporary license that's been restrained because of the overuse of restraint, seclusion and restraint. But taking that away and not having anything in place to support our employees who are, we ask these people in my community and the people moved to our community in St. Peter to work with very aggressive patients, and they are having an escalation, and there just does not seem to be any conversation here about what we are asking people to do in these facilities in terms of caring for patients. And if you cannot have a treatment environment that creates a positive outcome if you don't have a secure environment where the staff isn't afraid to go out on the unit. And believe me, I have seen this. I've taken nursing students to this hospital, and the staff huddle in the unit's main office that is protected rather than going out on the unit because the unit is not safe for either the patients or for the people that are working there. And I have brought this subject up over and over and over for 6 years, and we haven't seen a change in the outcome for the employees. Now, I think we should get regular reports as to what the seclusion restraints are in this facility, what the injury rate is for our people in our facility, and I don't see anything in this budget to really address this. For example, something that could be done is to get an outside analysis done, a root cause analysis of what is driving this problem rather than just our own administration doing it, because they may be looking at it through a filter that does not allow them to really identify the causes. Then you direct your resources towards really intervening. Mm-hmm. And I don't see it here. I haven't heard people talk about it in this budget or in the policy or in the overviews. And I can tell you that the employees there care very much about these patients. It's not as though they want to just handcuff these people or throw them in seclusion and restraint and leave them there. That is not what they're about. That's not what they're professionally trained to do. But they're afraid. And they don't see the administration being responsive. So I thank you for the little bit of time to I don't typically get like this, you guys, in these meetings. I know I'm sort of flat, but I've been flat for 6 years on this issue. I've raised it. I've talked about the data, the, you know, the background for it, and it doesn't seem to create a response. I'm going to ask over and over and over again, and I'm asking this committee to help me because we are not getting an intervention. We get good intentions, good goals, and good communication and conversation, but the outcome is not changing. And my community of employees are becoming very, very discouraged and despondent about the lack of concern about what's happening to them.
Commissioner Perry?
Mr. Chairman, just a couple of comments. I do think it's hard to look at ourselves. And using an outside analyzer is something we have done. We did bring SAMHSA under a grant from the federal government to take a look at our programs. And we can do that again. I really would be pleased to share the data and help people understand really the balance that we're trying to achieve and how difficult it's been to try to communicate as broadly as we can about the changes taking place. We are under a condition on our license, and the potential is that we would lose that license and we would no longer run the facility. It's the same issue that the chair raised about the sex offender treatment program. We can only restrain and seclude in certain types of circumstances. Because of that, we've worked really, really, really hard to try to train and retrain staff around what are the appropriate ways to restrain and seclude clients in emergency situations. But what that's done is it has created that kind of fear that you talk about, Senator Sharon. And having worked in an institution myself very early in my career, I know what it's like when you're not appropriately trained to work in the environment that you're asked to work in. So we are on the same page. We are willing to bring in other reviewers and advisors to help us more clearly communicate the secure treatment environment that we're trying to that we're trying to create at Security Hospital. And our job is to share data. Right now we're sharing with the court monthly data around the amount of time it's taking to move people into our competency restoration program. I think data turned into information is helpful to us all. So we can regularly provide you with data and anybody who asks on the number of restraints and seclusions, the number of staff injuries. We can really begin to hone down on where they're happening, too. We're really talking about two units in a rather large facility that we just have to do a better job, I agree, of preparing our staff for a very, very difficult work environment. So I'm not discouraged at all by the challenge that's in front of us and that we need to keep moving in the direction we're moving. And bringing in an outside advisor is not something we would disagree with. In fact, we would support that. And we have the resources to be able to do that in our current budget.
I'll just follow up to say, when you hear that the staff is not adequately prepared in order to deal with the highly aggressive, underlying that, I'm sure you all know that, is already the decision that the problem is, that the root cause of the problem is that the staff is not adequately prepared. And that so the intervention is going towards that. My question is that an adequate analysis of the problem? Because staffing could be an issue, staffing levels. We know that the facility itself needs an investment through the bonding because the facility itself is designed for hiding people and the staff not being able to see what's going on around them. There's much more to this issue than simply helping facilitate the, and that may be because you're not hiring the correct employees for the situation. There are plenty of professionals that know how to de-escalate anxiety, de-escalate psychoses, de-escalate fear that will result in aggression. So why is it that we have a staff of people that aren't adequately prepared? So I think we need a much more self-critical analysis of what we're doing there. And if it means we aren't adequately funding it, then you've got to tell us that. Because I think the legislature listens when you are able to demonstrate, based on an analysis, what's going on, why we should make that investment. because the patients deserve it. But our, when we ask people to work there and take on injury, our workman compensation costs, if you just want to look at it from a numbers perspective, which I don't, I think we need to take a look at it from a patient perspective, just like in schools. This is the last thing I'll say, I'm sorry. Just like in schools, kids can't learn unless they feel they're in a secure environment. Patients cannot get well who are frightened because of psychosis in an environment where the staff cannot create a safe environment for them. And the staff can't create a safe environment if they're scared that they haven't been given an adequate support system to protect themselves from injury. So this is a serious problem that we have to pay attention to. So I'm hoping that we get your dashboards, we see the trends, and if we don't see them improving, that we continue to press for better answers.
Thank you,
Thank
Senator
you.
Tarrant. In Senator Lori's absence, I'll continue to proceed the hearings. Commissioner Barry, do you have anything to add before we move on to Senator Hayden?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Barry, on the dashboard, and I won't prolong the hearing, there's another issue that has come up there around this issue of who are the clients and the demographics of the clients that are in the security hospital. And so that I've known that I've gotten a lot of calls about the disproportionate amount of people of color, in particular African-Americans, in the setting and the length of time that they stay. And I've heard everything from there's just not enough advocacy, that that's a front-end problem with the county, et cetera. But I have heard that there is, along with all of the things that Senator Sharon has articulated, I've heard that too, but also there is an issue around who's there and how long they stay and what their status would be. And so I've had activists, advocates, and just family members to talk about that. So in your kind of dashboard analysis, if you could add some of those indicators, I think that that would be helpful as well.
Madam Chair and Senator, we'd be happy to do that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll proceed if you're complete with your presentation with Commissioner or Chief Financial and Operating Officer Chuck Johnson, and Office of the Commissioner of Office of the Inspector General. State your name for the record, and you may proceed.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm Chuck Johnson. I serve as the Chief Financial and Operating Officer for the Department of Human Services. I'm going to start into the operations part of the governor's budget and go through the governor's budget proposals for the operations part of our budget. The bulk of the time, actually, for this presentation will be taken up by Jerry Kerber, our Inspector General, and Greg Gray, our Chief Compliance Officer, who will talk through a number of proposals we have to strengthen our work around fraud, auditing, and internal controls within how we operate and oversee our programs. I would like to start with two proposals that I'm going to talk about directly. You'll find on page 26 of the MMB document. And the first one is Fast Fact in your yellow sheets is number 51. And this is the system modernization proposal. The two proposals I'm going to talk about, system modernization and the county performance management system, are both ones that the committee may want to spend more time on than we'll get to today. They're both proposals that have strong county interest in particular. I know the counties are interested in having an opportunity to talk with the committee about these proposals. I'm going to start with the system modernization. The governor recommends $29.1 million to modernize DHS technology. This is specifically targeted at replacing our current eligibility system and the current system that supports our child support enforcement program. A little bit of background on DHS technology. DHS from dollars is the largest tech agency in state government in terms of our technology spending. In fact, at the time that the merger was made with OET, now known as Minute Services, we actually had a larger budget than OET did in terms of our IT spending. We operate many unique business applications, and in particular, four major systems that we're really targeting with this modernization effort. Our MAXIS system, which supports eligibility for all of our programs, our PRISM system, which supports child support enforcement, the MMIS, which is the claims system that pays all of our claims for health care, And the Social Services Information System, or SSIS, which supports social services and child welfare functions. These applications are really substantial in terms of the size and scope of how they support our work. They really are the backbone of the operations of how we do our business. We spend about $13 billion a year in state and federal dollars. 85 to 90% of that goes through these major systems. They really are the place for which we account and expend and distribute all the dollars that we spend out to providers who provide services to individuals who receive benefits directly from the state in the form of food benefits or cash benefit or others. We also make a number of other payments through these systems to various providers and nonprofits who support our work. So in that sense, they really are a foundational part of how we operate the agency, carry a substantial amount of our fiscal risk in terms of how we distribute dollars, and thus are very key to our internal operations. But they're not just internal systems. These are really outward-focused systems. And in fact, the primary users, particularly the two systems I'll talk about today, MAXIS and PRISM, the eligibility system, and the child support system, are counties and county workers who administer those programs at the county level. Some of you may have actually met with county representatives already this session and heard from them about the need to modernize DHS technology. Association of Minnesota Counties, AMC, has this as one of their top five priorities. I've worked in the human services arena for about 28 years, and I don't ever recall AMC taking that strong a position on anything related to the operations of in the human services area. And I've talked in the last few weeks with two or three county commissioners who are very articulate on the issue. They understand the importance of this and how it impacts how the current technology and the aging technology is affecting their ability to deliver quality services, how it's affecting their staff, and how it's affecting their budgets. Let me just give a little bit more background on the two systems that we're really, with this proposal, targeting for replacement. And the first is our eligibility system, the MAXIS system. This determines eligibility, determines benefit levels, issues benefits to individuals who receive benefits through the SNAP program or through our cash assistance programs. And also provides for the county workers all the case management functionality around all of the cash, food, and health care programs. It determines eligibility and case management for about 900,000 Minnesotans. And it services 14 different programs. It's an integrated eligibility system, which means that it actually is able to take the information from an individual and go across all those 14 programs and figure out what someone is eligible for. And in that way, it's a very sophisticated, highly sophisticated kind of operation for 900,000 Minnesotans. We have about $1.3 billion that are directly issued through the MAXIS system. That's for the cash and food benefits that we distribute out to individuals around Minnesota. And there's about 2,700 county workers who use this system on a daily basis to manage eligibility for the 900,000 people on our programs. The Child Support Enforcement System, PRISM, manages all aspects of child support enforcement as well, including multiple data interfaces for the enforcement of child support, as well as accounting for all the funds that flow through that system. We have about $600 million a year in child support that we collect. That money flows into us, and we distribute it back out to the non-custodial parents and the children who need those dollars. All that has to be properly accounted for so that we ensure we're accounting for the dollars that are in current support versus back support on arrears, and that we're keeping track of that on an ongoing basis, as well as implementing enforcement tools such as suspending licenses, looking to other bank accounts and other authorities we have of ways to try to intercept taxes or gather dollars in other methodologies. And the PRISM system helps support all of that work that goes on within child support. I mentioned $600 million a year. The PRISM system services 269,000 cases, about 400,000 parents who have cases that are somehow within our child support system. And there's about 3,700 county users for the child support system. Again, a very intensive number of impact on the counties. Why are we bringing this proposal now to modernize our systems? I'm going to talk a little bit about how old our systems are. I'm going to ask staff to distribute that'll give you a picture that I'll walk you through in a minute. The MAXIS system was implemented in 1992. It was actually piloted, I believe, in 91 and implemented statewide in 1992, unless it's celebrated its 20th birthday a year or two ago. The PRISM system and child support was implemented in 1997. It's just passed its 15th birthday. Both of the systems use a computer language. Their mainframe systems use a computer language that's not taught in schools anymore. We have to find people to work on these systems from other organizations that may have been using the same technology, and the folks have gotten trained through the technology there. We also are looking now at about 25% of the IT staff who work on these two systems who will be eligible to retire by 2016. So the staff that we do have supporting the systems now are, like all of us, getting older, and we view that as a risk going forward, given these languages are not supported within current teaching within the United States. We also have a maintenance agreement with a company that supports this language. It's called Adabase Natural. The company is called Software AG. They're a German company. That maintenance agreement ends at the end of calendar year 2015. If we're still on these systems, we'll need to renegotiate that maintenance agreement. Software AG isn't terribly interested in continuing to support this language on a mainframe environment, which is where we're operating it. And our last negotiation on the maintenance agreement was very difficult, and we expect it'll be more difficult if we have to extend it. We would love to be off of these systems by the end of 2015, if at all possible. Let me take you through the handout that you just received. We really wanted to put this into picture form, and I think that if this committee or another committee would be interested, you could also bring in county workers who could really walk you through what they go through to try to get a case eligible for a particular program within the MAXIS system. This is really highlighting MAXIS, the eligibility system. And if you look on the second slide, you'll see this is what a screen looks like in MAXIS. This is what a county worker is working with on a daily basis. It's known as a green screen, a mainframe green screen in the business, even though they don't quite look green anymore. It also kind of looks like something you might have seen in a science fiction movie from the 50s or 60s about what computers were supposed to be. All of this requires county workers to understand a large number of different coding that they have to enter into all these different blanks in order to get the right results. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. I just wanted to give you the picture and sort of walk through this for you.
Senator Hayden has a question, and then Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson. It kind of brings back a little PTSD for me. I was a financial worker about 15 years ago, and I remembered how hard it was to try to get a case eligible. Do you have a sense, either listening to the counties or the analysis that you've done, how long it takes for a particular county worker to perfect this language and become productive in their job?
Madam Chair and Senator Hayden, counties tell us it takes about a year for a financial worker to really get comfortable with understanding what they need to know in the system. They're certainly able to be productive prior to that, but they often need a lot of help getting there, or they give up trying sometime before then, because one of the issues the counties have is just ability to retain workers. Attracting them when they see the part of their job is going to be spending all day working in this kind of a system, and then retaining them when they realize how complicated it is to try to maneuver through the system.
Madam Chair, well, it certainly had that effect on me, and so somehow 15 years later I ended up here thinking about how to work on this. One of the things that I also have heard from counties is that they set up complete teams or departments or sub-teams just to deal with the errors that county workers make, not because they want to make them, but just because of how complex the system is. So there's all of these kind of support teams that are attached to these financial workers in order to correct the transactions that have been made along the process.
Madam Chair and Senator Hayden, that's correct. Counties address this in different ways, but certainly there's a lot of burden on more experienced workers or supervisors in smaller counties to have to help new workers and to have to do second layer reviews to ensure that the data has been entered properly. It is a huge challenge to get the system to work properly for any individual case.
Senator Kiffmeyer, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do, although it's a little different direction. There's no question. You just take a look at these screenshots and so on. I think it's just a matter of paying for it and, those sorts of things. But I think customer service, your clients, staff, efficiencies, it goes without saying. And is that a COBOL language, or is that something else that's a unique language?
Madam Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, our MMIS system is in the COBOL language. The two systems I'm talking about are in a language called Adabase Natural, which is a mainframe language, and I think the company's adapted it to work in other environments. We still operate in the mainframe environment.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to follow up my actual question. I just was. Thank you. One of the things I have, when the counties use the software, in the initiation of this software, is this something that the counties paid for? Do they currently pay anything to the state for the use of that software? Do they pay anything for any of this, or is this all a state-paid system?
Madam Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, the counties, I don't believe the counties paid anything initially. Over time, we have spun some costs back to the counties. For example, we initially paid for all the hardware, the computers that actually sat on the desks out in the counties. That was phased out a number of years ago. I think at the time, a lot of counties didn't have computers on the workers' desks, and it was something new. Now, of course, everybody knows the need to have computers. We also had training labs that we kind of phased our way out of that were more supportive of the county. But this is, generally speaking, in the eligibility side, a system that is supported by state and federal reimbursement. The social services information system the counties actually contribute dollars to, that's where they have some very county-based functions that we support there.
So, Madam Chair, what I kind of see in all this is what the counties get out of it, you know, the state level or federal dollars paying for it, but the counties get a huge efficiency out of this and their staff. That's what they get out of it. But I think it's important to recognize that in their doing of this work and taking care of their county folks that they have, sometimes the state doesn't get recognition for providing software, even if it's antiquated. I'd sure beat the old way, which was something even more onerous and burdensome that was there. And it's time to make a step up here, but the counties will benefit on the efficiency side.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry, Mr. Johnson. We started working on integrated online eligibility last budget cycle. So have we completed the RFP process? Are we at vendor selection point? I'm going to have a couple of questions, so if you could, Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, yes, in 2011, the legislature required us to move forward working with the counties on designing and laying out specifications for integrated eligibility and to do an RFI initially to gather ideas for what is out in the marketplace right now for software possibilities for modernizing where we're going. We did that RFI last year. We collected, got a number of vendors that responded to it. We followed through with that with a RFP for a vendor to help us with the actual planning for it. We have that organization on board. It's KPMG. They're working with us on the planning and responsible for a lot of the work that you see behind the proposal that I'm putting in front of you today. We have also been working closely with the counties throughout this process on identifying what their needs are. The other piece that I mentioned that's directly connected here to what the work we're doing, particularly in eligibility, is the health insurance exchange. The health insurance exchange will have eligibility by federal law for what is called the MAGI population, the modified adjusted gross income, which is really most of, by numbers, most of the individuals who are on our Medicaid program in Minnesota, most of the families and children will be going through the exchange. We are also working in parallel to develop the software on the same product the exchange is using, which is a Curum IBM software, the eligibility functionality for the rest of healthcare, the folks that aren't covered within that MAGI definition, because we recognize that trying to get all of healthcare off of MAXIS and into one place at one time would be a lot more efficient than trying to sort of stage this out over time, more than it already will be, because the cash and food, of course, are going to stay in MAXIS until we're able to move forward with this proposal. So the exchange has been a significant opportunity to move forward as well.
Okay. And Madam Chair and Mr. Johnson, Is there federal match? At one time there was, I believe, 10-to-1 match. Are we getting any federal dollars with this? I'm looking and I might have missed something. But
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, we've leveraged a tremendous amount of federal reimbursement as related to the exchange and the development of eligibility in the exchange, including the 90% reimbursement that you're referencing, which is a special time-limited reimbursement offer from the federal government that extends through 2015. With this proposal, we'll be able to leverage some more of the 90%, but because we're moving into different programs and away from health care, we don't benefit from the same more generous levels of federal reimbursement. There's multiple levels of reimbursement here, and this is a piece we're still working on. But our expectation currently is that this $29 million would be matched by about $24 million in federal reimbursement.
Okay, nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Mr. Johnson. Oh, Ms. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson. Have we put money into this agenda in the past? Can you give us a briefing on that? And the second question is how is this going to help with the counties being able to start to collaborate and work their programs out together? There's still a disconnect there between the counties. And even though we got the DHS working with counties, how is that going to work with... You know what I'm trying to say?
Mr. Chair, really? And Senator Rosen, I think I do. in terms of putting money into modernization before, the Senator Benson was referencing the 2011 action. There was a $2.5 million appropriation to support the work that we've done coming into today. With the planning, we have some of that to help us with the non-MAGI part of the exchange that we're working on healthcare eligibility there. Other than that, there hasn't been a legislative appropriation directed toward modernizing or upgrading our systems in my memory. To the issue of working with the counties, I think that where this potentially plays into sort of the direction on county redesign, a lot of the conversations we've had over the last 4 or 5 years there is we sometimes have used the conversation of high touch, low touch. What's the state role? What's the county role? And the county's role needs to be in those parts of our service delivery system where we need to have high touch. We need to have someone on the ground working with an individual. The state's role is more with that low touch, high tech. And I think to the extent that we can move our technology more into a self-service orientation where individuals can go out and apply online, they can update their cases, maintain and manage their cases online, that helps to move toward less reliance on having to have county workers doing all of that work at the local level and a greater ability to which that can become something that is managed through technology and at the state level. I'm not sure if that exactly gets at all you had packed into that, what you were asking, but that's, I think, where I see it fit.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson. This is fascinating for me. I used to do IT implementation, but we had a really failed project at the state where we tried to do it ourselves. I'm sorry, I don't remember the name and I don't remember the dollars, but are we doing an out-of-the-box software, something that's been tried by other states so we have a high probability of success? And are we going to minimize the amount of fiddling that we do so that we can keep things upgraded as we go forward?
Senator Benson, health match is emblazoned on my brain. Painful experience for all of us.
Yeah.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, yes, health match. well, and I think to be honest, I mean, part of we have to answer that question. I mean, part of being here is that we did have a project that was attempting to be the first step toward modernization, and it didn't work. And we need to take that step again, and we need to acknowledge that we're I think, better prepared to do it this time. We are definitely looking at using commercial off-the-shelf software as part of the foundation of how we move forward with the eligibility and child support pieces of what we're doing. What we did with Health Match was really kind of the old way of doing business in the human services environment. We hired a vendor and gave them binders and binders full of program requirements and said, here, you know, build a system that does this. And that methodology is actually how PRISM and MAXIS were built. It's something that worked a long time ago, but we weren't the only state that experienced problems with it over the last 10 years or so, where that model didn't seem to really be the model that was effective anymore. I mentioned earlier the IBM Curum product that the exchange is using for eligibility. That's one of the more advanced COTS products that's out there that certainly was, when we did the RFI, was the one that jumped out at everyone. But there are other products out there, too, that we think give us a much better starting place. So we're not starting from scratch trying to build something. We're starting off a product that's already proven and tested and then only doing some configuration and customization to make it work for Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to spend a lot more time on the packet. I think, as Senator Kiffmeyer said, it kind of talks for itself. But I did want to just show you that it can take over 50 screens on slide 5 for a worker to get through all of these screens in order to determine eligibility for someone for a particular program. And then just to show you what's on the last couple of slides here, this is actually off the demo product that IBM Curum has out there. This is the software the exchange is using. And it just gives you an idea of what this can look like, the self-service aspects, the ability to have a dashboard that a case manager, a financial worker can work off of so they can manage their caseload, and the kind of navigation tools we're all used to, buttons and lists and drop-downs and so forth, as opposed to memorizing four-letter codes and so forth that we have in our current systems. Mr. Chair, just a couple of other final comments on this one, and I can stand for more questions. I've touched on a couple of issues here. I think we've already talked about that a lot of the benefits of moving forward on system modernization are to the clients that we serve and to the counties who provide that direct service. The clients that we serve, their ability to use online tools to manage cases, to access services, to find out what's going on with their case, to communicate with us, all tools that are largely absent from what we do now. And certainly the counties, as has already been addressed, and their ability to manage the caseloads that they have that have been growing. And if for the counties, with the growing caseloads they face, they haven't been able to hire a lot more staff to do that. And so it's been a struggle for them to deal with the old technology at the same time they're dealing with more cases. We also believe it presents an opportunity for us to improve our internal controls over the money we distribute through these systems, how we do eligibility, the audit tools and the fraud detection tools that we have built in to many of the newer products that don't exist in our current products. I'd like to mention a couple of specifics on the fiscal aspects of this request. One is that within the $29.1 million, there's $4.2 million that is set aside in the first biennium for the DHS share, or the Medicaid share, of the operations costs going forward of the health insurance exchange. That's where you find this part of that cost. Those dollars do need to be appropriated to DHS so we can leverage the federal reimbursement that comes with it to support the exchange. And as I said, the exchange will provide a tremendous amount of functionality to DHS customers through the Medicaid program for the MAGI population. So there's a significant benefit to DHS from that investment. Secondly, and perhaps somewhat more curiously, $18.8 million of this proposal is a contingent. It's contingent on the state receiving approval under waivers in the Reform 2020 long-term care package. You'll recall when Assistant Commissioner Coleman was here talking about Reform 2020 that we're still waiting on waivers from the federal government. Those waivers, and they're different pieces of it, but they provide the state with more federal reimbursement than we're getting now. And there's about an $18.8 million difference between what's reinvested in the Reform 2020 and what would otherwise drop to the bottom line under the Reform 2020 proposal. Because we don't have those dollars in hand yet, we need to have a budget request that is also contingent, such that if we don't get those waivers approved and we don't get federal reimbursement, we won't spend this money. That would mean, if this goes forward as proposed, if the federal government said no to some or all the Reform 2020 waivers, we would have something less than the $29.1 million to spend, perhaps as little as about $6 million if all of the well, $10 million, including the Hicks part, if all of that $18.8 million did not materialize. We do expect we're going to get those waivers approved. We would certainly love for that to happen before the session is done, so we all kind of know where we stand relative to this. But right now, within our budget, in order to make it balanced, we needed to direct this to a contingent appropriation.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Johnson, you know, it's probably been, 9 or 10 years since I've been on this committee. And if you could go back to 2000 and see how much money they have spent on modernization and system changes, I would appreciate it and give us a report back. Because I know there has been some initiatives brought forward, and I'd like to see where they're at.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, we can do that. I might want to talk with you offline. I'm not sure particularly other than Health Match and bringing up a child care system, which we did in 2008, where we've done significant modernization.
I would appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, you'd want to probably tease out, you know, I know we've made a lot of modifications to accommodate changes that the legislature has required, and those have actually come at significant cost because of the inflexibility of our existing system, and it's right. Part of what we're talking about. Hopefully over time this new model, one of the benefits would be that the legislature would have a freer hand to ask the department for changes that would be a little bit easier to accommodate without significant budgetary outlays and time delays. There's ones I can remember that took 2 years or that were just plain denied because the systems changes couldn't be made to accommodate the policy direction that the legislature wished to go. I'm sure that Mr. Johnson would want to tease out how much of that you'd want in that view and how much you'd want out, and, you know, what do you consider modernization versus policy-driven change items that were requested?
Mr. Chair.
Senator,
as you can imagine, there, as you said, we all have a little trepidation about how much is being spent on modernization, if it's going to continue to be efficient and do what we're supposed to be doing here. And plus, we have $18.8 million that has to be approved. So, you know, there's a lot of fill in the blanks here. Just stating that I'm very concerned about this investment and making sure that we get it right.
Yes. Other questions? All right. Next item, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, the next item I wanted to cover is the county performance management system. That's also on page 26 of the MMB document. It's fast fact number 50. Mr. Chair, in 2009, the legislature created a group let me back up a little bit. The legislature in 2009 debated county redesign. And in that debate, there were a number of different proposals that were discussed. And ultimately what passed was really a couple of pieces that took different forms. But the foundation really of what passed in that bill was that the foundation of the relationship between the state and the counties in human services should be about performance. And if the counties are meeting the performance expectations and meeting outcomes for people that we have laid out for them, then the state should, A, be willing to consider providing more flexibility in how the services are delivered, and, B, not try to be specific about what structure counties use in delivering those services. The latter piece kind of going to the discussion around should counties be combined into groups and so forth that was debated in 2009. Out of that legislation, the legislature created a performance steering committee, and that committee was charged to study and develop a performance management system for the county human services delivery system and to bring a recommendation in the form of a final report in December of 2012. That report was issued. I had the pleasure of serving as the co-chair of that committee for the last 3 years with Commissioner Tony Carter from Ramsey County. And we had a great group that worked very well over a long period of time to develop and put together that system. The governor is proposing to pick up the recommendations of the Performance Steering Committee and proposing a $1.5 million appropriation to support the work that the department would have for furthering the recommendations of that committee. The performance management system, as proposed by the Performance Steering Committee, is focused on continuous improvement. It's also focused on accountability. That is, when counties aren't meeting standards, that there would be accountability to them for not meeting those standards. But we really wanted this to be a joint ownership of continuous improvement and improving the outcomes for the people we're serving, not a gotcha game between the state and the counties about who's not meeting which standards and why. The legislation that the committee has drafted and that will be part of the department's budget bill really provides a significant role for the commissioner, and the $1.5 million proposed here is really to support that work. The commissioner would be prescribed to develop measures and standards across the human services programs. The steering committee report recommends a place to start with measures to use for measuring county performance. But we recognize that this needs to be an ongoing process, needs to be a living process, not where you put a set of measures in law one day and just kind of leave it there forever. And that responsibility will really rest with the commissioner, and part of the duties of the commissioner to really work on developing that ongoing system. We also, the committee also recommended performance council, which would really continue the balance kind of between the counties and the state and our nonprofit partners in how we oversee the performance system. We felt that was a really useful part of the steering committee. We want to continue that with the council. That will be required to staff by the Commissioner of Human Services, and again, we need some resources to help sort of staff that. We expect that to be a very active council, to be very involved in the oversight development of measures and standards within the new system. Also, as part of accountability, the counties will be required, if they don't meet performance standards, to develop performance improvement plans, negotiate those with the department, and potentially face fiscal sanctions down the road if they're not making progress in improving. All of that work will require some support by the department to carry out and manage those performance improvement plans. And then finally, the committee felt very strongly that the state needs to provide technical assistance to counties in general across how they can improve performance, and very specifically target at those counties that aren't meeting performance standards and helping them try to improve their performance. An additional piece of that is peer-to-peer technical assistance, not just what's coming from the department, but also what can happen between counties and learning from counties that are succeeding, helping those that aren't doing as well. So the governor is proposing, as I said, $1.5 million. That's about 9 FTEs for the department. There's additional money that would go to provide some funds for developing a dashboard that will be outward facing toward the counties that we could develop into a way for them to really monitor their ongoing performance. And then we'll use some of the additional money for bringing in expertise to help us in developing new measures and providing training to counties, both on performance management related issues, as well as particular issues within particular programs. And Mr. Chair, I can stand for questions on this one.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Can you tell me, what is driving this? Is there a particular one or two counties or three counties that are outliers here, and then a number of counties that are effectively functioning in a way that they might not be as crazy about having an oversight committee like this?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, it varies by program as to which counties are outliers and whether there are a lot of counties that are outliers. And one of the challenges that we had in trying to develop the system and the discussions within the committee was trying to identify what is an appropriate standard of performance to set. In some cases, we've set those either collectively, you have, through legislation. In some cases, the federal government has set them. But in many cases, we haven't really developed what the standard of performance is. The steering committee has recommended some, but we're also recommending that the commissioner continue to work with the counties on developing what those standards of performance should be. There are some issues where smaller counties struggle more. There are some issues where larger counties struggle more. And I think in the larger counties, it often has to do with the demographics of the population they're working with being very different than you might see around the rest of Minnesota. And in some cases, for the smaller counties, it is a function of the fact that they're very small and they don't see certain kinds of cases pop up very much, and that makes it harder for them to be able to effectively serve all the kinds of different situations they might see with the limited staff that they have. So there isn't a way to generalize that statement. The impetus that came from the 2009 legislation was simply that we need to have clarity about what our expectations are from counties. And if counties are meeting those expectations, that's good. And if they're not, we should use that as a reason to take action on counties, not based on other reasons that people may have of thinking a county is or is not doing what they're supposed to do.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I just would follow up that I don't disagree. I think we should be clear about our expectations and that our counties, when we're spending dollars, we ought to have accountability in relationship to that. But we can build these systems on systems on systems of reporting and responding to requests for information that consume, whether it's in the hospital with all the paperwork that the nursing staff is doing rather than taking care of patients, that this kind of building these systems on top of systems on top of systems are just driving administrative costs rather than dollars directed towards caring for people. So I hope there's something else that's eliminated to balance this that's not useful or is not working or not necessary, and that there is a message along with this that other costly administrative requirements are eliminated and that the administrative request is towards something that will be more useful or effective. And I hope that it isn't just a few outliers that are creating a huge administrative system to be put into place. So I hope we'll discuss this further.
Senator Rosen is next, but real quick, Mr. Johnson, how many more do you have to go through just time management-wise? Are we going to finish today, 15 minutes?
Mr. Chair, for me personally, this is my last one, but then Mr. Kerber and Mr. Temper. Gray have 8 or 9 of them that they're presenting.
Okay, that's fine. I'm just trying to get a sense of where we are. Senator, and it's fine to dig in. We need this information. Senator Rose.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for indulging these questions. And Mr. Johnson, exactly what Senator Sharon was saying, I'm very concerned that perhaps we're just limiting these reforms to the for more documentation, more burdensome reporting by the counties, and not and just the relationship between the state and the county. Perhaps we can look farther in these outcome reforms and look at how to make the relationship between the counties better and have that the joint services and how we're going to combine those services. I think we're just looking at this steering committee in a very narrow focus, and we have to look at on a more broad focus. That's where you're going to see the true reform, the true cost savings. And I think in part that's where the counties are starting to want to join together and say, okay, what can we provide together, what kind of services we can. And for some of the members that don't know, I have one of the two counties that share human services, Martin and Faribault County. And so they made it work. I think there are some issues still that could be addressed. I think it's a little heavy on administrative cost in that county, but they do share their human services. So, and we've had a push recently to look at what these counties can share and joining their forces. So make a long story short, just if we can just look at this a little more broad than just the state-county relationship.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, I agree completely, and that was actually the intent of the 2009 legislation. This is one piece of what is being brought forward, which is really to try to build that foundation so that we have, between the state and the counties, clarity about what it means and what we are expecting from the counties and what they need to do. The other piece, the other big piece, was really a redesign council, which is really focused more on some of the issues you were raising, which is this issue of how counties can work together more broadly. And that's been coming along as well. You mentioned in your district as well in southwestern Minnesota, there's a number of counties just in the last few years that have combined together with what have been a long-term Lincoln Lyon Murray group. A number of other counties have joined that to create Southwest Human Services. We know in the southeastern part of the state there were 12 counties that worked on a proposal. Didn't work for all 12 of them, but 4 of the remaining counties are still working on some kind of a joint arrangement amongst them. I think that the theory was that these are kind of the chicken and the egg. To some extent, the performance can help to drive those discussions. If you have counties that aren't meeting performance standards, that's a way for them to start thinking about what do we have to do to fix this. And that might be looking at what our neighbors can offer, looking at how we can do business differently in a regional perspective. Or similarly, counties just looking at, we think we need, in order to really deliver what we need to for people, we need to get exercise and leverage more from the folks around us. And I think to Senator Sharon's point as well, I agree as well, this will really require the department to change the way that we do business. This isn't just about adding something new on and kind of running this thing up here. It's really about how we take this framework and use it to change the way we relate with counties such that we're spending more time working with them on how to improve performance and less time on paying attention to whether or not they're meeting this process standard and that process standard, and whether all those process standards are actually still adding value, which is kind of the next step of this work, is to start to explore whether we need to have all the process pieces in place that we have. We have very good examples now where we work very strongly with counties around performance in ways that they're very supportive of, in the child welfare, child protection and foster care, with the disability waivers, where we started a similar kind of review process where we really sit down with them and work through on a regular basis a number of cases. We do a very thorough review. It helps us to understand what's not working within the system. It helps them to understand where they need to improve and do better moving forward. It's those kind of models we want to build on within this this new framework, not just to have something where we're managing a bunch of data going back and forth on 16 measures every year and a bunch of paperwork. But I agree that there's a danger you end up there if you don't do it the right way.
Other questions? We have, okay, seeing none. Mr. Johnson, thank you. We have the Office of the Inspector General. I know they're here today and available still tomorrow morning. Eight budget items, I understand. You want to try to do one or two?
Sure. One a minute.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the Inspector General for the Department of Human Services. And we have about seven. The two of them have been combined, and I can kind of walk through them. I'll tell you what they are, and maybe you can decide which ones you want to hear in the limited time. Four of them are related to program integrity, related to investigations of fraud. There's one related to the home and community-based waiver redesign. You heard some about that. Our part of the redesign effort is we'll be licensing a variety of services, and we'll have a fee structure that'll be in the bill. Another one is real briefly about some background study changes we're going to be proposing. And then there are the child care changes regarding the mortality review panel report that recommended some changes to family child care. So those are kind of the seven. We have seven areas, and I can kind of hit on any one of those, Mr. Chair, that you'd like to try.
You know, I'm betting you could get through the program integrity fraud one in the time that we have, and that the others, just based on my volume of emails, might take longer than 10 minutes.
Mr. Chair, yes, I understand. The first one in that area is, and this would be fast fact number 59, it relates to an expansion of our surveillance and integrity review unit within the department. There currently are about 800,000 individuals enrolled in our programs. There's about 155,000 providers who are enrolled, 78 different types of providers. $8.6 billion is distributed for those services, but we have 10 people assigned to investigate.
It's on page 24 of the MMB document for members that are at the bottom. Didn't hear Mr. Kerber, sorry.
And so we have 10 current investigators, and there's far more work responding to allegations of something that may be going on with this employer or that employer. And so what we're seeking is another six FTEs for that kind of work. For each FTE that we have, there's a recovery of about $500,000. And so, you know, they're a good investment. And so that's one of them. And with that, we hope to expand our focus a little bit beyond home health agencies and PCA services. The second one in that general area is the MA provider recoveries. We want to manage that a little bit differently. And there's two parts to this. One relates to surety bonds that have been required already for some types of providers as a condition of enrollment, like PCA services, personal care provider organizations, and medical equipment suppliers. We have never, and when we discover an overpayment to a provider, generally we can recover that overpayment either through recoupment, as it's called, by decreasing their future payments, or we set up a payment plan. where we recover the overpayment. If the provider closes and goes away, it's hard to get that public money back. And so what we have required, though, for many years is a surety bond. But unfortunately, we never collected on any of them until last year we started pursuing that. And part of these activities, I'll step back a little bit, the Office of Inspector General is relatively new. It's a little over a year old. And it was kind of a reorganization of our administration by taking the licensing division on one hand and then adding a separate division that's a collection of all the financial fraud and abuse investigation activities within the agency and collecting those up into one division. And so what we're looking at is a lot of system issues within our own agency. And so that's what these are coming out of. And so this is one where we've discovered that we can do a lot more by way of collecting public funding that's gone out there by just collecting on some surety bonds. And in the process of a couple that we've encountered, we've discovered some problems with the requirements that were in place, like the department wasn't a recipient or wasn't a benefactor of a payment. So a beneficiary is called. So we have a couple of changes related to that and a couple of positions that will do that. The other one, or it's one position for that. The other one that's interesting is we, as I mentioned, we recover from providers overpayments at times. And as soon as we identify that there's an overpayment, our obligation is to let the federal government know and give them their share. And so we pay them about 50% of what we've identified as an overpayment. But if we are not able to collect on that because the business is closed, we can, under law, go back to the federal government and say, we need that money back because we weren't able to actually collect it. And we've never done that before. And so we're starting to do that now. And part of the reason we've never done it, there's money sitting there to be taken, is because we haven't had anybody to do it. And so that's one of the other positions in here is to actually request an FTE for that. Doing okay on time, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, four minutes.
We have another one with provider screening. And this is to be in compliance with the Affordable Care Act.
What, help us with the page.
Okay, this is Fast Fact 61. Okay. I think you have the same numbers as I do.
Yeah, I think those are part of COVID.
Previous what page is it from here?
Okay. It's called a slightly different name. It's Medical Assistance Provider, ACA Provider Screening Requirements. So you have different page system there. I'm not sure what that is. But what this is, it's following up the Affordable Care Act requirements that we institute a system that has pre- and post-enrollment inspections by providers, of providers who are determined to be high risk. With this, there's a new enrollment fee that's required by the federal government and set in federal law, so it's going to be about $535. And then providers are categorized as low, medium, and high risk. The high-risk providers, those will be...
In the MMB document on page 23, titled Application Fee for Provider Screening, is that correct?
That would be it, Mr. Chair.
Okay, then
yes.
Now we can
yes.
All...
Sorry about that.
No, that's all right. That one wasn't cross-referenced in the fast fact in the MMB, but we can write it in, and we're all with you, Mr. Kerber.
So with this new categorization of risk, there are different requirements that will kick in. Everybody has to pay the enrollment fee, but it's not all current providers. It's only new providers coming to the state, and they don't have to pay the fee if they're a Medicare-enrolled provider, and they don't have to pay the fee if they've already enrolled in another state. And so it's a subset of a subset here that's going to be paying this fee. But at any rate, the risk assignment is low, medium, or high, as I mentioned, and if they're high risk, then the owners and managerial officials are going to have to have a fingerprint-based FBI record check as part of their background study. We already do background studies on them, but so this will be an expansion of that. And if they're medium or high risk, then they have to have a pre- and post-enrollment visit. And so that's what these resources are for right here. is to do that pre- and post-enrollment visit to determine whether or not the provider is really has the some of it is whether they're qualified, whether there's actually a business in place, in hopes that we're going to prevent some fraudulent billing. And the last one under the
real quick, Mr. Kerber, mm-hmm. before we move on, you know, I noticed a significant return on investment on the other items, and this one doesn't really show that. Maybe just get into. I mean, if we significantly curtail the pay and chase model and we're better at recovering mm-hmm. revenue, why wouldn't it cover the costs of this mm-hmm. program enhancement?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's a good question. What we calculated in here is only the fee that they'll pay and the monitoring activity. We didn't go the next step and calculate any savings that we would have as a result of that kind of work.
Okay.
It's going to be kind of new work, and we don't know how many providers will actually prevent from enrolling based on this system, and then how do we calculate what was saved as a result of their not being allowed to enroll, and then after they've enrolled, it would kind of kick into the other work that we do at that point. So
maybe we could push you a little bit on recognizing some of those savings
yes.
as well.
That's a good point, Mr.
Budget.
Chair. Because overall, these program integrity proposals that we have bring back more money than they
right.
cost. And so this one was tied only to those fees, and I think we could look at it differently. Thank you.
Okay.
The last one is in this area is the
I think we're going to cover the last one tomorrow.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Kerber. Look forward. We'll take you up first so that members know. Then we will again begin public testimony. We will again be in this room for tomorrow's hearing. And with that, we stand adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.